Good evening and welcome to this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. On today's show, we have part of a talk by David Niewert, who recently wrote the book Of Orcas and Men, What Killer Whales Can Teach Us. The talk was given at Book People of Moscow last night. Niewert spoke about the precarious status of the Puget Sound orca pods and the Pacific Ocean in general.
Can I ask here how many have seen wild killer whales? So a few of you have. Well, let me first impress upon you how easy it is for you to see them. It's a 6-7 hour drive from here to Anacortes. And all you have to do is get on the ferry and go to San Juan Island, take a picnic basket, have a few days if you can, and have a book along and go out to Limekiln State Park or the land bank out there on the west side of the island. Do it in June or July and you're going to see whales. And it's a lot cheaper than SeaWorld and 10 times better because you're seeing them in their natural environment. So it's actually very easy for people living here in the Northwest to see them. It's easier than you would think. You have to plan a little bit to go to San Juan Island. Usually, you know, motels aren't always that easy to get. And there is camping out there, but it can be tricky. So, you know, if you want to go, look into it a little bit, do a little research. But believe me, it's much simpler than most people think. Anyway, so these are the whales that we see the most constantly in the Northwest. This is they're called the Northern Pacific ecotype. The one on top is the male. They grow to be between 32 and 35 feet long, and that dorsal fin can grow up to over 6 feet tall. And they weigh between 12 and 14,000 pounds. So they are very large animals. The females, you'll notice, are considerably smaller. They only get to be about 8,000 pounds and about 24 feet long. It's kind of an unusual species in that way, that there is what they call sexual dimorphism. There's a big difference between the males and females. And then down there at the bottom is a calf. Calves are about the size of a teenage human, so and they come out that way. Calves are an important part of our story too. But the interesting thing about these whales is they're not the only whales that we see in the Northwest. We also see these a different type of killer whale called the transient or Biggs killer whale, and these whales only eat salmon. In fact, 80 to 90% of their diet is strictly Chinook salmon. They're very picky eaters. And the transients, on the other hand, are voracious marine mammal eaters. They eat seals, sea lions, porpoises, dolphins, just about anything that moves in the water they will eat. They've even been seen eating moose. Because the moose up in the Alaskan archipelagos in British Columbia will swim between the islands, and on two different occasions, scientists have observed them taking down a moose that was swimming between islands, which would be something to see, I think. But so we actually have a third ecotype called the offshores, and they live about 100 miles offshore. There's a population of about 70 to 90 of them. We don't know a lot about them because they're so hard to study. And these guys, they figured out, eat almost strictly sharks, specifically Pacific sleeper sharks, which are these really big 16-foot deep-diving sharks that live down in the trenches out there off the continental shelf. And they team hunt these sharks. One of the whales will bash the shark in the side of the head, which stuns them and renders them immobile. And then another shark will come and grab its tail and flip it upside down, which means that the shark can't breathe in a normal fashion, and so it will actually drown as it's upside down. And then once the shark dies, the whales dive into it and rip it apart, and they only eat the liver. So they also, these transients have also, especially up in Alaska, will take down humpback whales, young humpback whales, is what they prey upon. And when they eat them, they only rip out the tongue and the lips. These are all the very fatty parts of these animals, and that's why they go for really fatty food, just as the fish-eating orcas eat fatty chinook. There's a strong preference for high lipid count among these whales. But so just those three ecotypes illustrate what we've actually got going on with this species, because it's not just one species. Transient killer whales and the resident killer whales have not interbred in something between either 300,000 or 700,000 years, longer than humans have been around. And so scientists have really had to readjust their thinking about the species in terms of preserving these populations, because these are animals that are very, very particular about who they breed with and how they interbreed, and it's all based around their culture and who they are raised with. All of these animals live with their mothers their entire lives, although there is some dispersal, or that is movement of males out of the group among transients. As transient pods get large, they're finding that there's a lot of dispersal with transients, because transients best hunt in small pods of 5 to 7, because they're very stealthy hunters and very quiet. So they've seen some dispersal with transients, but the residents, they literally live with their mothers their entire lives, and when the mother dies, they'll sometimes move to other pods. There is a famous, sort of famous in the whale community, whale named Onyx. He's an L-pod whale. And when his mother died, he suddenly started swimming with the J-pod whale, with Granny J2. This has kind of thrown everybody off in terms of, well, how do these whales decide which pod is which, and that sort of thing. We know that each of the pods, each of these population groups, has its own set of calls and communications that they use. Some of these calls are distinctive to their individual matrilineal pods, so that it actually serves as a sort of identifier for the when they make these sounds, we know which pod they're from, because they're making the distinct stereotype sound. And they're in every ocean on the planet. They are far and away, they've been around for 6 million years. They're far and away the most successful marine mammal in natural history, because they are so widespread. But each of the populations of them is distinct as an ecotype, and that ecotype tends to revolve around the culture, and the culture revolves around their prey. The southern residents we can observe them doing, a lot of their behavior is based around herding salmon in a certain direction. The transients are very stealthy, silent animals, because they're running around trying to grab rock sausages off the rocks. And they don't behave at all like each other. There are the North Atlantic whales, orcas, who will both do herring balls, where they round up large numbers of herring until they form a ball, and then they'll dive through the middle of the ball and just gobble up fish. And those same whales have been observed eating seals. So the North Atlantics are kind of still of a mystery to us because nobody's done proper study of them. And in fact, the Northwest whales are really the orcas that we really know much of anything about because they've been studied very intensively. But the largest population of killer whales on the planet is actually around Antarctica. There's over 1,000 orcas around that continent, and there are 5 different ecotypes of very distinctive populations there in Antarctica. The echolocation issue and the bonding, social bonding that it's part of, is also part of this bigger picture for killer whales because we're also learning that there's also this organ that they have up here called the paralimbic cleft that is unique to killer whales, or not just killer whales, to dolphins, to large dolphins. Bottlenose dolphins also have it. But it's extremely, as the Dr. Lori Marino, who did this MRI, says, it's just a ridiculously elaborated structure, very complex, and we have no idea what it does. It's very close to the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that does the emotional learning. So it's probably associated with emotional learning issues. We do know there's a lot of anecdotal evidence, mostly among trainers or scientists who see them in the wild a lot, that they have an extraordinary sort of sensitivity. They seem able to read our minds sometimes. I'm sure they're not, but there is something going on there that they're extraordinarily sensitive to. And it seems that very likely that this paralimbic cleft is part of that. But what we do know is that they are unusually empathetic animals, that they have a great deal of empathy, not just among themselves, but they are also able to treat other animals with empathy. Now, not necessarily seals or sea lions, but I'm sure the seals out there would be very eager to disagree with me on that. But, so part of the story is also part of the book, a lot of the book is really about looking at the relationship, the long relationship between humans and killer whales. And it goes back to, I spend a fair amount of time discussing Northwest Coast Native Americans because they have a really long history with these animals. This is a petroglyph that's out at Olympic National Park at it's a place called Wedding Rock, out on the very far western coast near Cape Alava. And the macaw, it was carved by macaw watchmen. And the macaws were whale hunters, but they hunted humpbacks and gray whales. So they never hunted orcas. And in fact, none of these tribes ever hunted orcas because they were considered animals of great and deep spiritual power. And they were really closely bound up in their mythologies. Most of these Northwest coastal tribes actually saw orcas in various forms as the equivalent of humans who lived under the sea, and they often called them the people under the sea. And let me tell you, they do, you know, Ken Balcom, the great whale researcher, has told me this great anecdote. Back in the day when they were first doing the IDs on these animals, and really up until all the way through the 1990s and early 2000s, they had to use regular cameras with film in them, right, to shoot these whales. So that meant that their longest roll was 36 shots. And Ken said, I swear to God, they knew exactly when I hit 36, because that's when they would start breaching and doing all this crazy stuff, and I'm trying to load my camera. they were showing off for my, this is a juvenile that decided to show off for us one day out by a kelp bed. And yes, you can. I took this shot at Lime Kiln State Park. They do come right up to the rocks there. You can actually see them better on land than you can from a boat, because they will come right there. You've seen them, right, Rachel? You guys? And you've seen them there, too? So, and yeah, and this was this shot I took. This is Cappuccino K21. He decided to spy hop me one day as I was in my kayak at just off of County Park. And it looks really cool. But let me tell you, your heart's totally in your mouth. These guys are in the water. You really know that you're in the water with a 12,000-pound animal with large teeth when you're out there with them. And there are lots of ways to see them. This is a whale watch boat. This is one of my favorites. This is the Western Prince. And they do very ethical whale watching. There is a problem with whale watching boats in that they put up a certain amount of sound, noise. And in the summertime, especially on busy weekend days, you'll see 50 boats around these guys, right? I mean, usually the way you see them out there in San Juan's is you can tell when the whales are approaching because there's a flotilla around them. And so this is a problem, especially because the boats can also force the orcas to change direction in their feeding and expend energy unnecessarily. And then there's also a problem with boaters who don't care about orcas just being jerks, like this guy. This is a very near collision. This is just an impatient fisherman who didn't want to have to wait around for the orcas to clear out before he revved up his engine. And so he ran right through the pod, and sure enough, just as he was running through, this guy decided to spy hop. But really, the bigger issue that they have out there is these large ships, because these ships put up terrific amounts of noise underwater, to the point that orcas will actually stop communicating when they get in their presence, and it destroys so much of their echolocation function because they're not able to get the bounce back from the sounds that they send out, because these ships go wang, 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 wang underwater and put up so much noise. And, you know, there's also a looming problem potentially with oil coming down from Vancouver. The Canadian government wants to expand the oil port in Vancouver so that all those tar sands oil that were supposed to go down the Keystone XL pipeline, since that project now appears to probably be dead, their alternative is to build a pipeline across Canada from Alberta over to Vancouver and expand the tar sands port in Vancouver. So if that happens, you'll be seeing a lot of oil coming out of Vancouver, and this oil is not crude oil. It's called dilbit. It's diluted bitumen. And the dilutants that they use to make this stuff be able to flow through pipelines and into boats and off of boats are these extremely toxic and volatile chemicals. Remember that train that blew up in Quebec a couple of years ago, blew up a whole town? Well, that's the chemicals that they're using to dilute this bitumen. So if they were to actually have a spill out there in Harrow Strait, which is entirely possible because they have to navigate these two extremely hard right angles to get from Vancouver down past San Juan Islands, and it's very easy to imagine one of these ships losing power in a bad storm and running aground. If that were to happen, what would happen is the bitumen would hit the water, and the bitumen part would sink immediately to the bottom. It doesn't float like crude oil does, and it would form this toxic mat on the seafloor that would remain there for generations and destroy all the sea life in the area. And the dilutants would separate and form this extremely toxic, extremely volatile gas cloud over the entire area. If it got lit, it would turn into a giant fireball. If it didn't, it would just kill any air-breathing animal that encountered it, including the humans that live out there. So all around, this is a very severe existential threat to the orcas. But far and away, the biggest threat that they face is the lack of salmon. All of these other issues kind of fade into obscurity compared to the problem that killer whales have with our salmon populations. As I mentioned, that the residents eat mostly Chinook, and they're picky eaters. And those Chinook runs have been in serious decline over the last 40, 50 years, really even longer than that. And now we're discovering that, well, it's something we've actually kind of known, but now we have scientific evidence to back it up, that these orcas spend their much of the fall, all of the winter, and most of the spring living on the continental shelf west of off the west coast, eating Chinook, mostly from the Columbia River. They've been doing pretty well in the last few years because the Chinook runs have actually been surprisingly strong up the Columbia the last 2 years, and 3 years now, mainly because 7-8 years ago, Judge Redden ordered them to start spilling water over those dams on the Columbia to help the salmon runs. And this is just a tiny measure. Is sort of a half measure to help preserve the runs, and it's already had a really great effect. But there is now a very large push on from people in the orca community to tear down those four dams on the Snake River that probably most of you know about because it's certainly an issue around here. It's considered very much a significant component of helping the southern residents survive and perhaps outlive or surpass their current endangered status, because they are endangered. They've never recovered from that capture period. When they took those 58 whales out between 64 and 76, they realized that there were actually only about 78 whales left in that whole population. We got back up close to 100 southern residents in the late 90s, and then because salmon populations crashed, so did they. So we're now in the process of trying to, or certainly the orca scientists are working hard to try to convince our policymakers that if we want to keep these animals around, we need to do something about the salmon. And it begins with the Columbia, but it also includes all the runs in the Puget Sound, and particularly we need to be looking at the runs on large river systems like the Nisqually and the Skagit. Those don't perhaps impact folks here, but I'm sure you're all familiar with the issue of the four dams on the salmon or on the Snake. And in fact, I want to mention here and now that there is a coalition being formed between orca advocates and salmon advocates inland to form a sort of tag team approach to dealing with this issue. Certainly bringing in the Endangered Species Act into the picture will change the picture legally for the status of the people trying to bring those dams down. And there is, in fact, going to be on Saturday, October 3rd, a sort of the first event that involves both the folks from Western Washington and the folks over here called the Free the Snake Flotilla and River Recreation Day. It's going to be down at Wawawi Landing. And people are going to bring their kayaks. And I'll be there. I know a few other people are from Western Washington are going to be there to support that. And Britt, is that? No.
Yes.
Yeah, Britt, back there is a gentleman who is one of the main organizers of this event, and you should all talk to him because it's going to be really cool. Anyway, so this gentleman here, I mentioned him earlier, this is Paul Spong. He's probably the godfather of all the orca scientists. He's been studying them in the wild since the early 1970s. He actually got hired by Vancouver Aquarium in the late 60s to be their chief orca trainer because he was a scientist. And he did all kinds of things with these orcas when he was working with them in captivity. He played music for them and tried to do all these kind of cool, interesting experiments. But Paul got into trouble when he stood up in a public meeting and opined that, if anybody asked him, no, these animals are so smart and so intelligent and have wit and a sense of humor that he didn't think that captivity was appropriate for any of them. And Vancouver Aquarium fired him 2 days later. So then he moved up to Hansen Island, set up his lab is on that island that's there behind his head. This is one of the stations where he has volunteer researchers come out every summer and they help track the orcas there in Johnstone Strait. But the actual orca lab is back on that island you see behind him. And let's see, and this gentleman here, this is Ken Balcom, who is the man who lives on Sandman Island and has been doing work with orcas there, wild orcas there, for 40-plus years now. And he's a very dedicated guy, and I think he's very close to retirement. He got cancer a few years ago and has been recovering from that, but he's actually been in pretty good health the last few years. So I talk about the people who actually took on the work of saving the whales, and these two are probably the most important. Here I'm going to see if I can play this sound. So this is when they vocalize. This is apparently the main way they communicate. These are all distinct calls, and they, as I mentioned earlier, you can tell which whales are which population they're from, just by the kinds of calls that they're using. And then we have echolocation sounds. And I wanted to play what those sound like for you. They're a little harder to hear. That's a whistle. This is when I was with a couple a pod of northern residents, and this mother had a calf who was playing around in the water behind me, and she started just echolocating me like crazy. And so there's the echolocation sounds. So they're much harder to hear. He's going, wow, that's crazy. And I was going, what about the calf? What's he doing? Then I realized that the calf was getting the bounce back from the mother's signals, that he was able to see me because the mother was also sending out these echolocation sounds. And this is how they share. There you go. And that's what they sound like. Sometimes they'll put them together in these chains. They go, which you'll hear. I think there is one of these click chains. And then there's the kelp that I hit. Hey, I do organic recordings, man. What can I say? And this is how they see underwater and see each other as well. That's a click chain right there. Anyway, and these sounds are all created by this organ that's up in their blowhole, and this melon in the front of their heads is not where their brains are. The brains are back in the skull casing behind their eyes. It's an acoustic lens that they send the echolocation sounds out through, and this is how they're able to get these amazing sounds. So anyway, let me wrap up real quick. I think a lot of what people would like to know is, well, so what can our killer whales teach us, right? This is the subtitle of the book. And I won't give away too much, but I will say one of the important things is that these animals, as I said, have been around for 6 million years. They've been on top of the food chain for most of that time, certainly the most successful apex predator on the planet. And 6 million years is a long time. So how have they been so successful? We've been the apex predator on land now for maybe 100,000 years. Actually, in the last 150 or so, we've come closer to destroying the planet than any other creature has, as far as we know. And our own long-term prospects for survival are actually not looking that good. So when we think about that, I think it behooves us to look at the animals that have been successful, and certainly killer whales have been one of the most successful. They're certainly closer to being our counterparts under this, our undersea counterparts than any other animal. And a lot of what we know about their success is that they form these extremely tight family bonds. They are amazingly non-aggressive towards each other, very little internal strife, just unusually cooperative animals, particularly with each other. In fact, they seem to know what each other is going to do well in advance of when they actually do it. So one of the things I think we can say is that killer whales have demonstrated that empathy is not the disadvantage that we think of it as being when we are humans, but rather they've established that it's an evolutionary advantage. And I think that that's one of the critical things that we as humans could really learn from them. Certainly we can learn a lot of other things, including how not to destroy the other animals in our ecosystem. But I think at a bare minimum, the things that we've learned about these animals for over the last 40 years is that they are so intelligent and so critical to our global ecosystem that we have real ethical obligations to them, both the animals that are in captivity. I think we have a lot of ethical obligations to them, as well as those that are in the wild. And I think much of what we need to do as human beings to save ourselves is also part and parcel of what we need to do to save the whales. So thanks for coming out tonight, and I'll be happy to take any questions.
That was part of a talk by David Niewert, who recently wrote the book Of Orcas and Men, What Killer Whales Can Teach Us. David Niewert spoke at Book People of Moscow last night. That's it for this special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843, or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. Bob Hoffman recorded David Niewert for this program. I'm Lee Robertus. Have a great weekend.